right, everybody. This is the Meat Eater Podcast. We're coming at you. I want to say we're coming at you live from Ketchum, but we're not. It's not live. We're coming at you dead from Ketchum, Idaho. And before I get into the main thing, Ketchum, Idaho, the way I always knew Ketchum, Idaho, and this is my first time I've ever been in Ketchum, Idaho. I'm here for a backcountry hunters and anglers get together. And I always knew it was being like where Ernest Hemingway, the writer who wrote perhaps the greatest fishing story of all time, The Old Man and the Sea. You guys read that?
Yes, sir.
He shot himself to death here. And right here in town, his grave's here in town. And I always knew that. And it was funny, this book just came out called Hemingway's Guns. And like it was always rumored that Hemingway shot himself with a Boss shotgun that he bought at Abercrombie and Fitch, which is totally funny because now Abercrombie and Fitch sells shirts to say Abercrombie and Fitch on them, but you used to be able to buy guns there. So he supposedly shot himself with the shotgun. And it turned out these guys did this book recently called Hemingway's Guns. They did a bunch of research and they realized he shot himself with a 12-gauge shotgun that was a W.C. Scott and Son. After he kills himself, apparently like someone, his family, brings his shotgun down to a welder here in town to have it destroyed. The guy smashes the stock up, cuts it in little pieces, and goes and buries it in the field. One of these writers goes to find this whoever this welder is. His kid still runs a welding shop as of a couple years ago. The kid pulls out a matchbox, showing him some parts they kept off this shotgun. The guy looks at it. He says, "That's not a Boss shotgun. You know, that's a Scott and Son shotgun." And he apparently, this shotgun, he like hunted ducks in Italy, shot shooting competitions in Cuba, went to a safari in East Africa off this shotgun, favorite shotgun. Kind of a weird deal. Right here in Ketchum. And Ryan Callahan, who's sitting right here, told me that whenever he runs out of alcohol and he doesn't have any money, he just goes and takes the offerings that are left at Hemingway's tomb.
It's right across the street.
When I asked him about this, he says, "I can walk over and get some alcohol for you right now at the Hemingway's gravesite." And yesterday, sure enough, we're standing there in town here. We're standing there, and he told me this, like, "Oh, yeah, people are always going to his grave." We're standing there, and two dudes come up, and they're like, "Excuse me, sir, would you know where the cemetery is?" And I'm like, "Let me guess," you know, and sure enough, I'm sure they're heading over to Papa's tomb.
Well, yeah, I mean, what are your thoughts on that, do you think?
That it's bad to steal it?
Is it bad to steal it?
No, because when they put, someone told me, like, normally you put plastic flowers at a grave. Someone told me that they just periodically come and take them all and throw them in the garbage.
Yeah.
It's only okay if you're buying alcohol or guns.
Yeah, I think so. Not plastic flowers. Now, something formal. The Meat Eater Podcast, brought to you by First Light, based right here in Ketchum, Idaho. It's an original hunting clothing brand. They make high-performance hunting apparel. I wear it all the time. These guys pioneered merino wool hunting clothing. Like the first ones to take that fabric and technology and bring it into hunting clothing. They make everything to get you covered for hunting, from your merino base layers out to waterproof, breathable, technical layers. Like I said, the good thing, and you're going to find this out in a minute because two of these guys are right here. The guys at First Light actually hunt and fish real hard all year round, and they test their stuff endlessly, and it shows. And the weird thing is, if you ever want to call them and ask them a question, an actual dude will answer the phone, like a real live person will answer the phone and answer your questions. Or you can make it even more simple. Go to firstlight.com, check out their stuff. Fantastic materials. And the Meat Eater Podcast is brought to you by the Meat Eater TV show, hosted by me, Steve Rinella. I've got one of our producers sitting right here next to me, Giannis Longtong Putellis. We'll get to him in a minute. We air new episodes on Sportsman Channel, which if you don't have it on your TV set, you really ought to get it. It's actual real reality TV, which is like the reality kind, the kind that they don't normally make. And the network, Sportsman Channel, is great because they trust us to make the show we want to make, and they give their talent, I don't know if it's okay to say talent when you're referring to yourself, they give your talent the freedom to do real things in a real way without having to dope it up into something that's embarrassing to watch. That's a note I made to myself, but it's totally true. If you don't get Sportsman Channel, and you ought to, you can still find all the Meat Eater you can stand at meateater.vhx.tv. You can stream it. You can download it. You can use the code Meat Eater Podcast, one word, Meat Eater Podcast, and get $5 off on any volume. So we package these episodes. What, five per?
Yeah, they vary, but four or five.
Four or five episodes per package. So that gives you like 2.5 hours of viewing pleasure. We got a ton of them on there. How many packages do we have now?
Six.
I want you to know that for a hunting and fishing podcast, this one's really integrated because the person you're hearing talking right now is not only a woman, she's Korean. Right?
Korean American.
Helen Cho. The most integrated broadcast you're ever gonna hear about hunting. what else do I want to cover? Yeah, Sportsman Channel, First Light, Meat Eater.vhx.tv. Hit Meat Eater Podcast for your discount. What we're gonna be talking about, and like I said, I have two, Ken Kruth and Ryan Callahan from First Light are here. Giannis Boutelis from the Meat Eater team is here. Helen Cho is here. And Helen, tell what you just did for the first time today.
I went fly fishing for the first time.
Helen Cho went for fly fishing. And so I was like, today we watched an otherwise honest person get corrupted. Because Helen Cho was, up until today, like a meat slayer.
Yeah, pretty much.
Helen fished in order, like Helen went out to fish. She used to go out to fish in order to kill fish and eat them. With a spinning rod. You like to surf?
More conventional, yeah.
You like to surf fish? You like to fish? You fish
party boats?
She likes to party. Charters. She likes to party on boats. No, she likes to fish. She likes to fish on party boats. She used to go out and was a fish killer. And today, she was corrupted right here in Ketchum and went on an outing that was meant to be to catch fish, to poke holes in fish's faces for fun, and then let them go. So Helen became a fly fishing, catch and release angler today.
I don't know if you become one if you go once, but
well, you dabbled in it.
It was, yeah, the introduction.
She was lured,
the beginning of the end.
She was lured to the dark side of catch and release angling today, right here in Ketchum. I was with her. I caught a fish and let him go. I caught him on accident, but I caught him and let him go. And that's one thing I want to talk about today. It's the thing that's perplexed me my whole life, and I've said on both sides of the fence is, and I packed this room with fly fishermen. Is what, like, I want to talk about why do so, like, what is it with fly fishing? Because we all know that fly fishing is, you know, technically, right? Catch me if I'm wrong. The real only difference, like, to define fly fishing would be the fly, the lure, is delivered by the weight of the line, right?
Yep.
And on spin fishing, the lure is delivered by its own weight when you cast.
Yeah.
But there's massive amounts of cultural BS. There's massive amounts of like cultural and ethical stuff has been laid over. What's the difference between spin fishing and fly fishing?
Yes, and that's something we covered today. Like, I look at fly fishing as a means to catch fish.
This is Ryan Callahan talking.
That's it. Right? And there is, just like you said, there are massive amounts of opinion and chunks of like nostalgia heaped upon how you fly fish. But for me, it is a means to catch fish.
And was the first fish you ever caught on a fly rod?
No. No, not at all.
What was the first fish you caught?
I would think it's a rainbow.
Because you grew up in Montana.
Yeah. Yeah.
You caught them on what, a worm?
Man, you know, my mom used to have us round up grasshoppers out of the garden. We take a bobber, a hook, and float it down a Prior Creek on the Crow Indian Reservation outside of Billings.
Yep.
And catch a lot of
fish. Prior Creek, like the Prior Mountains. It has some wild horses in it, right?
Yep, exactly. Yep.
And you guys catch them. Would you thump them in the head, or would you?
We would keep quite a few fish, yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, Ryan, I'm going to get real technical about fly fishing for a minute, but Ryan was sharing with me today. We were talking about all the do's and don'ts of fly fishing, all the ethics of fly fishing. He was saying that around here, guys will fish a dry fly. They will not want to strip a woolly bugger, which is apparently not how one fly fishes. But they will run a nymph rig, which is basically bobber fishing with a fly rod. I call a fly, like, what do you get, a strike indicator?
It's a bobber.
I call it bobbers all the time. It pisses fly fishermen off. You say, what are you guys, bobber fishing? Yeah. Well, no, it's a strike indicator. I'm like, yeah, that's what it is with my four-year-old. My four-year-old uses it to indicate when he has a strike.
Yes.
Yeah. But we'll say it's a bobber. know.
The funniest thing about that too is that they had all these different kinds.
Right now, you're here in Canton.
Is that they had all these different kinds of bobbers for years, right? They had these, you know, fuzzy things, this and that, and now guys just have thrown it the towel in. They use bobbers
for real, like a spring-loaded bobber.
Well, it's a little bit lighter, so it casts a, but it's like a basically.
Are you
round.
Referring to a thingamabobber?
Oh.
Because it's thingamabobber.
When it comes to fly fishing, yes.
Will you use one?
No, I didn't use one, but I will use one. Heck, I like to catch fish, man. I'm not. I use indicators all the time. But
tell these guys what you just got back from doing today.
Steelhead fishing. I was up on the Klamath, and it was exceptionally good.
And tell explain the whole thing. Like you had a 7-year dry spell or something like that.
Oh, I mean, I have been. You know, we kind of go regardless. It's a family reunion kind of deal. So the fishing is a secondary program. So we just kind of show up, and if the fish are in, the fish are in. Traditionally, the fish are not in this year
because the time of year, or just because like the rivers have because those rivers have been so degraded, and the steelhead runs are not what they used to be and all that.
All of the above, but you know, with steelhead fishing, it's one of those things where you're either, you know, and you quickly find this out is that you arrive and everybody there is like packing up and saying you should have been here last week. Just the classic example. But this time I was there last week, and you know, this was traditional.
You were there this week.
I was there this week.
It was the week,
and it was off the charts. It was like as good a fishing as. Even the old timers there, fishing there for 40 years, said it was the best fishing they'd had in 40 years.
Now, I want to explain something real quick. So, a steelhead, like, there's a term, anadromous, right? So, anadromous means that a fish lives in the ocean, or in the case of the Great Lakes, lives in a lake and runs up the river to spawn. And then the opposite of anadromous, catadromous, where a fish, like an American eel, is catadromous, lives in the river and goes out to the ocean to spawn. But steelhead are river run. Are like sea run rainbows. It's a rainbow trout that, you know, he's hatched, he's born, goes through his larval stage or whatever, his youth in the river, goes back out of the ocean, turns into a big fatty, comes back out the river. Guy like Kenton goes down there and catches one, and it's not too big. And sometimes it's hard to tell if you caught a rainbow or a steelhead.
Certainly, that's on the younger fish. You know, a young steelhead will be, you know, 2 pounds and 18 inches, which, you know, for a rainbow, that's a great fish.
It's a giant fish, yeah.
And steelhead, you know, they can get up to be huge. I mean, you know, not uncommon for a guy to catch a 10-pound fish.
What was the biggest one you guys got?
I caught a 9-pound, probably 8.5, 9-pounder on a dry fly, which was kind of cool.
And there's no doubt that fish had been out in the ocean for a couple of years at that point. I mean, he's just a full-on balls-out steelhead.
Full-on, and we were only 15 miles off the coast.
Was he clipped? Was he a hatchery fish?
No.
Wild born fish.
Wild. And in fact, all the fish I caught pretty much were wild.
No, you probably can't even thump those fish, right?
You can't keep them.
So that's legally enforced catch and release.
Exactly. And then if you have, one guy on the trip caught one with a clipped adipose fin, and we smoked it and ate it, and it was fantastic.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah.
So if it's got a clipped fin, if it's a hatchery fish, you can keep it.
Correct.
And then you guys thumped it?
Yep. Brought it in, and it was probably a 7 or 8 pound fish, filleted it, and then smoked it all day the next day in the smoker.
You know, adipose fin means, it just means extra fin. Like, it's like a little fin on their back. It's not clear what function it serves. Probably serves some function. They used to cut everybody's tonsils out because they didn't think tonsils right. Serve any function. So adipose means extra. My brother Danny has an adipose nipple. He's got a third nipple. Yeah, he's got a third nipple on his chest.
Right.
He calls his adipose nipple.
Way to blow up his spot.
So what they'll
do? How is it adipose? All men's nipples are adipose.
Well, I know, but it's extra adipose. It's like the extra. You know, it's, you know. So
oddly enough, he didn't show that to me when
you didn't bring that up.
No.
And you fished steelhead with him.
Yeah, I fished with him.
Steelhead with him in Alaska. So he's got an adipose nipple. And the adipose fin, like when you take a fish, if you want to know that he's a hatchery fish, they just snip that little fin off. It's kind of like it sits between the dorsal fin and the caudal fin, which is the tail. There's like this little thing on there, and it's, I don't know.
It's like floppy. It doesn't.
Yeah, like, I don't know. It might be some kind of vestigial thing. Like it used to do something that it doesn't do now.
Agreed.
So if you want to mark a hatchery fish, you just snip that thing. So what Kenton here is saying is that a wild fish, it was like, hatched and reared in the wild, is hands off.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the other way around. If you could have killed one of those fish, you probably wouldn't have killed it though.
I would have kept one or two.
Really?
I already had the smoker. I mean, I was going to fire it up, and you know, I might as well fill the little. It was kind of a small smoker. The goal was to fill the smoker up. Yep. You know, if you're going to run it, you might as well.
The smoker.
One thing I kind of like today. We fished this morning when Helen got corrupted. We were fishing for cutthroats. I have kind of honestly quit killing cutthroats.
Yeah, I understand that.
In rivers, like wild cuts, because cutthroats as a species, there's certain species in this country that are just sort of, you know, they have highs and lows, but the general atmosphere, they're generally going downhill. You know what I mean? Mule deer, it's like, you know, like people are predicting in some ways, you can predict the end of mule deer. Like they're sensitive, and sure, you'd be like, oh yeah, the golf course, there's always mule deer on the golf course. But in general, like, mule deer are... Things don't look great for mule deer right now. Number of things like drought, habitat loss, you know. A lot of issues we could correct if we felt like it. If we had the energy and the money and we didn't care so much about being inconvenienced, we could fix the situation. Cutthroats, another thing, they're just like generally seem to be going down. Even talk of putting cuts, some strains of cuts on the endangered species list. So I like to go out and get them. And this kind of like hits the conundrum of what I'm talking about when I want to talk about this on a podcast is I like to go out and get them, okay? I don't want to kill them because I'm like, yeah, you know, like I just feel the pain of the cutthroat. So when I hold a cutthroat, I feel the pain of the species, right? And I know that the individual, like the essence of the species isn't wrapped up in that little individual fish in my hand, but he sort of stands for something that's in decline. So I see him and I want to let him go, but what is it that made me want to poke a hole in his face and reel him in, you know? Because the dirty secret about catch and release stuff is there's some mortality.
Yes, there absolutely is.
They don't, like, it depends on water temp. It can be high as 15%. What have you ever heard?
Yeah, about there, 15 to 20.
Yeah, I was telling you a story. Tell me a story you were telling me the other day about, as a guide, how many fish you guys are laying in a day.
Well, there came a point when, well into my guiding career, when I would start to...
Tell where you were guiding. This is a weird deal. The guide is talking right now. The guy that's talking right now, Giannis Poutelis, works on Meat Eater. And the show knew my... Are you so sick of hearing this story? Giannis knew my...
I retell it
often. Giannis knew my wife in high school. Okay. So my wife, when we met, my wife's like, the only person I ever knew to like to hunt like you guys do is this guy, Giannis Poutelis. So just in one ear and out the other. Like, I never paid any attention to what she's talking about. Just like, you know... No, I'm joking. But you know, I saw this. And one day I'm looking at this magazine, Western Hunter magazine, which is one of my favorite hunting magazines. And I'm looking at Western Hunter, and there's a picture of kind of like that iconic image of a dude with a pair of binoculars up in the mountains. And it says, like, Giannis Poutelis glasses the Colorado high country. And I right away call my wife at work. I'm like, who's that dude you're always talking about? Giannis something or another that likes to hunt? She's like, Giannis Poutelis. I'm like, I'm looking at that dude. He's in the magazine right here in my lap. So we connect through my wife's Facebook. And it turns out that Giannis's wife is a botanist, and they're spending some time up in Fairbanks. And so we were going up to do a doll sheep hunt for the show, and we hired Giannis to carry a backpack. Everybody fell in love with him. And at the time, you were guiding.
Easy thing to do.
Yep. At the time, Giannis was like guiding elk in Colorado, guiding elk in Arizona, doing some coos deer stuff down in Mexico. He started working with us, and eventually we wooed him away from all that. But he was a trout guide for a long time, and he's now going to relate like an observation he had about how catch and release fly fishermen can't quite have as bright of a halo hanging over their head as they might like. Spin it, Giannis.
Yes, because I felt like with seasoned good anglers that were competent and knew what they were doing, when the timing was right, when the fishing was hot, you know, mostly it was for us the month of July. And this is central Colorado, the Eagle River, the Colorado River, the Roaring Fork, down outside of Aspen. We could catch 40 to 60 fish, sometimes per angler, in an 8-hour float. You know, when the fishing's hot, you know, a fish is hitting the dry every, you know, couple minutes. So you can rack up the numbers. I never did it, but we definitely had guides that would run the clicker.
Really?
They really wanted to, they were proud of their numbers, you know, so they would sit there and click fish. Anyways.
Like a golf clicker. Or does Orvis make a clicker?
Just, I don't know. Just a counter.
The Orvis fish clicker.
I don't think they
may.
But But when you get into those kind of numbers and then you start talking about 10% mortality rate, you know, that's a lot of fish that die every day. You know?
It's more than some dude down there with some snelled hooks and a box of crawlers.
Well, as long as he is abiding by the rules, in most places it's 2 trout a day, you know. So if he catches his 2 and leaves, then he only killed 2 and he probably didn't poke too many others, you know. Where we would poke 50 and, you know, if we're losing, you know, 5 to 10 of those fish.
Yeah.
A lot of dead fish.
And meanwhile, whenever he goes by that dude on the bank, like some dude at the bank, 4 or 5 kids up and down the bank in diapers, and he's out there drowning crawlers, and you know, mm-hmm. they're like, oh, look at that guy, you know.
I did a
like, see him walking back with the stringer, and you're like, that guy.
One of those chain stringers with the clicker, yeah. The wire clasps on.
I helped the Division of Wildlife do a dead fish count once on the Eagle, and we floated down. We didn't really float. We like kind of crept, skidded down the Eagle River, super low water, just going over rocks the whole way. Warm water temperatures. I think we picked up 24 dead fish. You can just see them on the bottom of the river, you know, white bellies up.
Red spots on their lip? When you look at them, just count them.
No, we were taking them, you know. I want to say that 17 out of those fish, you could see the handprint on them from where they were probably held up for a picture. And, you know, like you were telling Jimmy today, wet your hands before you touch the trout. And so many people don't know how to properly handle a fish. And so then that mortality rate goes even higher.
Yeah, we're talking about my little boy. I wanted him to let a cut go. And so I was telling him, you know, get your hands wet before you slip it under your belly. I know, like, I'll tell you, I remember the exact instance I ever in my life. Is it instance or instant? I feel like I always screw that up. I think I know the exact instance in my life when I heard the term catch release fishing. Like, my old man, I'm not even going to get into why this was okay, but in my old man's eyes, like bass season began on whatever day, okay, in Michigan. Let's say it was June 1. And so we all thought it began on midnight. Rather than looking at it began on June 1, we talked about like began on like the 31st at midnight. And he thought, well, as long as it's starting up at midnight, which was technically the next day, we were allowed to fish that day because we couldn't be up at midnight. We had to go to bed. So we were allowed to fish and keep bass, but we couldn't cut them until the next day when it was well into season. So we had a live well. I grew up on a lake, and we had a dock, and we had a live well that my dad made out of. You know those, you know when you're at a grocery store, and they have those bread racks, like the big rolling racks, the plastic perforated shells mm-hmm. that have all the loaves of bread on them.
Yeah,
he just took a bunch of those and zip tied them together into a live well and put styrofoam around it, and we could fish bass all day and put bass into the live well, and then season would start. So the next day we'd get all our fish out of the live well and flam. I'm not telling you to do this. So we did. And I was trying to get, and I was so,
Steve
I was
Ranella
so,
did it.
I was so little that I was still getting. My parents were still giving me baths. Okay, I remember that because I caught a big, huge bass 2 docks down on Gary's dock and hauled that thing home and was trying to get it into the live well and dropped it. And I was devastated. And I was so young that my parents would give me baths. Because I remember that night, I was getting a bath. My mom was giving me a bath. And I was still so distraught about the bass I lost that my old man came in and told me some people fish just to let them go as a way to try to make me feel better. You know? And I later got into it. I got into like in steelhead, and like I don't mean this is gonna bring down the steelhead you like to catch, Kenton, because in the Great Lakes we have steelhead. Like the Great Lakes are like an aquarium where you turn like all the fish that were in there are kind of like either not there or they're hurting. But then we have great. It's a great fishery of imported fish. So we have great. You know, we have all like almost all the Pacific salmon. They try to get Atlantics going. We have pinks, coho, chinook. We got lake run browns. Okay, there's tons of fish. Steelhead. And we used to count them. And like for us, I remember the best year I ever had, my 3rd year of college, I think I landed 44 steelhead. And I probably thumped 2 of them. I thumped one of them when I was dating this girl from Sarajevo because I wanted to cook one for her. And I thumped another one at some other time. And we mostly just caught them just to count them. You know? And you were badass if you could catch 100 steelhead and let them go. And I would get where I look down on the dudes doing it. And then I'm going to quit talking mostly after this, but I just want to continue. So we got so into fly fishing for steelhead. And then the steelhead wasn't always good. So then we got way interested in going to Mexico and fish for bonefish. So then my brother and I went down to Mexico to catch and release bonefish for a month. And we would fish bonefish all day and let them go. And then in the evening, we'd catch other fish to eat. And I would, in my day, look more forward to going and trying to catch little snappers and grunts and stuff out of the channels in order to eat. Because we just had a bag of rice, a bag of dried rice, a bag of dried beans, water, and we ate fish. Or we ate conch. So here we are, we're like, oh, no, we're not going to kill the bonefish because some reason I can't explain. But we'll kill all these other fish. We don't even know what the hell they are. They're just fish. Like, no idea what they're just like. Oh, this looks like a edible fish. We eat them. And eventually I just get dizzy from all the, like the, what, you know, the why.
Why is this better than
yeah,
this?
Yeah, and then I know some of you
guys. Why is this worth saving?
I know
why
some of the guys at Fish Catch and Release, and they're like, well, I'm not going to kill these trout. I don't want to damage the fishery. You know damn well when they get done, they go to some restaurant and order fish. They don't know where it came from. It's like, what about that fishery?
Yeah. Yeah.
What's that fishery doing?
We talk about this on the hunting side of things all the time. You know, it's like, I was hiking with a friend of mine's niece, taking her mushroom hunting this spring, came across an elk calf. And
you ate it?
And we ate it. I bonked it. I landed it fairly. No, and she said, well, where's the mom? But, well, she's probably up in this meadow feeding. We were kind of on the fringe of this big meadow. And she's, well, what's, should we, like, stay here and help the calf? And I'm like, well, if a bear comes by, he came by it honestly. And she's like, well, we should save it from the bear. It's like, well, what makes the bear less valuable than the elk calf? You know, it's like, and why is that up to us to decide that?
Yeah, exactly.
So the whole steelhead fly fishing is a great topic because that's like to our very first conversation that we made where it's like, this is how you fly fish. But you look across the river at the guy with the, you know, single pin rod and he's running 300 yards of mono down the river on a slip bobber and he's crushing fish. You're like, I bet I can make this fly rod do that.
Yeah.
And catch more fish. And you know, a lot of times I call it like playing with house money, right? Like I'll go out and I will nymph or run the bead, right? And that's very controversial in fly fishing. We've talked about that when we were up in BC, honest.
You mean like a beadhead nymph?
No, you run a bead. Like you go
meant to look like an egg.
Yeah.
That's controversial?
Yeah.
It's not honest.
It looks
it's
like
not
bait.
Pure.
It doesn't have an egg or it doesn't have a hook on it. Nobody tied it. It's artificial. You take a toothpick, you jam it, so it sits above your hook.
So it's basically like running a flasher. I don't really know about this. Now I remember you guys talking about this when we were hunting in BC. Yes.
Yeah.
It's no different than what the guys back in Michigan do with running like a sack of eggs with like a hook a couple inches below it.
Yeah. Like a stinger hook.
Yeah, same thing. Yeah.
So you're saying that it's controversial in I don't want to say elite, in like... What's the best term for like extreme, like the pure, like it, okay, in a, from a purist fly fishing perspective?
I don't know. I'd be like
it's controversial to run a bead.
A traditionalist.
Would, a traditionalist.
Yeah.
A traditionalist won't run a bead.
No. I mean, a lot of these traditionalists won't even. They're just all about dry fly. Like even nymphing is.
They don't want to catch a fish on a wet fly.
Yeah, it's just kind of it's you know, looked down upon.
But you can swing a wet fly.
One of the best arguments I ever heard, and it's one of the oldest arguments out there, was the late, great Lee Wolf, who...
famous fishing writer.
Exactly. Yeah. And, well, and he tied up the Royal Wolf, which is still a fish-catching machine.
But it doesn't replicate anything.
No, it's just an attractor
pattern. So is a MEP spinner.
Yes, sir.
No, I know.
Okay.
Let me finish my story. But his deal with why he wasn't into fishing, because I think during his fishing career... Fly fishermen started to basically fish below the surface. And you started using sink and tip lines and adding weight and whatnot. And he was...
What do you know when this was? Like, what year?
I'd have to guess it'd be 50s, 60s.
Unsubstantiated. Moving on.
Rejected.
But he felt like by doing that, you weren't given, like, the fish just a day off, a time to of reprieve. Like,
gotcha.
He felt like you should be catching them on the surface.
When they want to eat on the surface. Exactly. When they're not, it's like you give them a break.
Exactly.
That's interesting.
Here's the thing, though. I'm gonna try to make a parallel. I'm warning you right now, it's not going to work. Okay.
people will say, oh, I hunt wild, and I like to hunt wild pigs, okay? So I'm guilty of this because I hate, if I could wave a magic wand and make wild pigs be gone, I'd be very tempted to wave the magic wand because of the damage that wild pigs do. I mean, they hurt ground nesting birds. They cause a lot of, you know, economic trouble for people, a lot of ecological trouble. So if God came down from the skies and says, like, here's a stick, if you wave this stick, I will eliminate the wild pig from North America, I would carry that stick around, seriously consider waving it as a guy who likes to hunt wild pigs. But people are like, oh, we need to hunt wild pigs because they're overpopulated. Okay. So if that's the case, why aren't they happy when they can't find a wild pig? But they get bummed. They're like, it was a terrible day. We couldn't find a pig. I'm like, but shouldn't you be glad? Because isn't the goal that there aren't or not any around? So when I'm out wild pig hunting, I'm always like hoping to run into a bunch, but it's supposed to be like, well, I kind of should be hoping to not to, right? Because I want them to not be here. So if a guy really wants to have something be super difficult, so you're gonna use something that you know doesn't work well. You're only going to use dry flies. But then you're happy when it works well. So you're happy if you get a 40 fish day. So what is it? Is it then not challenging, and then doesn't it cease to be what you wanted it to be, which is a challenging form of fishing? It just worked really great. You caught 40 fish. You outfished the dude throwing MEP spinners. You outfished the dude throwing worms. So now you should throw it away and start fishing worms because your dry fly works better than that, and you want it to be challenging. Answer that.
Well, no, because, I don't know if there's a question there, but
you know it's only 10% of the time that you get that day. You fish all year for a couple days like that.
It's like the gimme. You know, the gimme hunting, when you're like, oh, walk 10 feet from the trailhead, and there he was.
You're not going to not shoot.
You don't go,
you got to shoot.
That was too easy. I didn't like that. You go, I just spent 12 years, you know, swinging a fly waiting for this day. Just spent 12 years hiking up those mountains, and I'm definitely going to take this gimme.
Yeah.
And look, right? I lived on a great dry fly fishing creek, Gore Creek, in Vail, Colorado, for a year, and in our backyard.
Gore Creek?
Gore Creek.
Never heard of that one.
Exactly where after, is it and how great?
It's pretty darn good. Gold medal. Named after Lord Gore, who just went through those mountains and
he raped and pillaged. He hired Jim Bridger as a guide.
Exactly.
Jim Bridger got so sick of that guy shooting everything, Jim Bridger quit him.
Yeah.
He killed grizzlies in places there aren't grizzlies within 500 miles there, mm-hmm. No. He killed a grizzly out by Glendive, Montana.
Yeah. The Indians tried to run him out of that country.
This dude had blood on his hands. He killed he had a little tally. Talk about a golf clicker. He's like, 2,000 bison, 1,200 antelope. Yeah, Bridger got sick of him. Anyways, Gore Creek. Your buddy Gore.
Yeah, so.
I prefer that over Al Gore. I'm glad it was named after it. Like, it's like an incandescent light bulb burning next to it.
When we first got there, and we noticed we had a great fishing hole, right? And every day we'd just be in there pounding them. You know, they'd be in there rising and we'd be in there just getting after it as much as we could. And eventually it was like, you know what? Let's just sit here and have a beer and watch these fish eat. Like, it's just as enjoyable. We don't need to catch these fish again. It's, you know, it's still your same cutthroat buddy sitting in the same hole. And so you don't always have to have those 40 fish days, even though the opportunity is there. You can catch a couple, maybe a dozen, and then just sit on the bank and enjoy yourself.
Well, let's talk to Kent. He just had a 40 fish day. How many steelhead did you catch?
A lot.
100?
Yeah, probably.
How many do you think are dead right now?
You know,
did
I don't
you
know.
Fight them to absolute exhaustion and then take like thousands of pictures of them up
just
on the bank?
Jimmy Houston a man, flop them up. No, I'm pretty gentle.
How many days?
He's trying to stun them. He's trying to stun them until they hold still for the picture.
I was with a 9 weight too, so I could definitely get pretty aggressive once they got close. Like, it wasn't like, you know, some guys will go steelhead fishing with a 5 weight, you know, and then that's when you really.
Because that fish is dog tired by the time.
Dog tired because, you know, you fish with a, you know, 5 weight would say 5x or 4x, you have no way, even when it gets close, the thing can keep running on you. You know, I was on a 9 weight with 2x, so even a bigger fish, if it got to the shallow water, I'd kind of Jimmy Houston it close, get it loose, and get it out. But I have no idea, you know. The whole time we were there, we saw one fish floating downriver upside down. It was still breathing. We turned it over, it had the adipose gone, we grabbed it, and that was one of the ones that we smoked.
How many did you catch all together?
As a team? Like, out of the 4 of us, we probably caught, I don't know, 100, 200 fish, maybe.
And how many days was that?
5.
5 days of fishing.
5 days of fishing. Probably more than that. You know, some guys fish more than others.
That's awesome. You kind of got the white whale, too. You got the...
Hey, everybody, hold on a minute. Hey, Dan? I just called my brother. Who's a fish. He's like, he works with fish.
Well, who cares? Have him take a picture of the nipple.
Can you tell me right now, we're recording something right now, so you're not live, but you're close to it. Why do fish die if you overplay a fish? Just real quick. Is it like something to do with lactic acid buildup?
I'm guessing it's lactic acid buildup and probably oxygen debt in the muscles.
What have you ever heard any ideas about what percentage of steelhead die after people catch them and let them go?
No, but there are studies on it, but it varies by water temperature and fish size and bait versus fly and a number of other.
So if I'm sitting with a guy who just caught 100 steelhead, what do you think? How many do you think he just killed?
Off the top of my head.
Yeah.
I'd say maybe a third.
Whoa, blood on your hands. All right, I'm gonna let you go. I'll talk to you later, man.
Wow.
Listen, I want to check it out. This dude's a fish biologist. He's an ichthyologist. So he does like ichthyology, but he does aquatic invertebrates for a university. He's full on PhD, great school of minds kind of guy.
Right. So you're saying he knows what he's talking about?
He knows a lot about fish. But he likes to catch steelhead and let him go.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? Kept more. Who knows what a man will do?
Should have just kept them all now. Ken's like selling smoked steelhead out of a bag of his truck, now like next to a taco stand. Oh, I got plenty.
We had a bigger smoker. I could have gotten that one fired up.
Now, Helen. As someone who's like, how many years you been fishing?
Maybe like seven, eight.
What did you like? So, what was your feeling? Like, let's say you had caught some fish today and let them go. Would you have felt
today?
Bummed? Yeah. Let's say you'd caught a whole bunch and let them go. Would you have felt bummed, or would you have felt like, no, this was just its own experience? It really had nothing to do with. It had nothing to do with catching fish to eat. It was just its own thing. We were enjoying a certain place, doing a certain thing that people have been doing for a long time. I'm putting words in your mouth, but like, what was your like? How did you look?
I
at
don't
it?
Know. I think if I had hooked it, if I had gotten it and it died, I would have probably felt a little bad.
Really?
But yeah, I mean, just for my entertainment that I'm going to go and fish. I don't know. But if I had released it, I think I wouldn't feel. I feel like it's like a separate experience. Like fly fishing is so far and different than fishing for meat to me. It's like.
Why is that?
I don't know. Like when I go fishing in New York, it's like I'm on a mission. I want to go out. I want to have a good time. But ultimately, I want to come home to fill my freezer.
Yeah, I went fishing with Helen and her boyfriend one time, and they come out there with one condiments for eating raw fish, and they come out there with a wire that when they kill a fish, they cut the fish's tail off and run the wire through the fish's spine, which does to the fish what, if you've ever been to a slaughterhouse and watch them slaughter cattle, they hit the cattle with a captive bolt gun, then they cut its throat, and then they electrocute it to relax its flesh. And when you run that wire through that fish's spine, he relaxes in a way that all the rocks in the world banged against his head are not going to do.
What?
And you spike his brain. Yeah.
Wow.
It's a Japanese process called Ikejime.
I got to remember.
Yeah. We'll put it on the website.
It's like running a clothes hanger through a fish's backbone, insert in his tail, and that fish just melts. He's like, ugh, I give up.
That is amazing. It's awesome.
You can really taste the difference, though.
I'm telling you, when I used to trap snapping turtles.
That is amazing.
Yeah, I used to trap snapping turtles and sell them. And you'd cut the head off the turtle.
Not your snapping turtles.
What I'm going to tell you is, no, I'm bringing this full circle. Bringing this back around to Joe.
Well, hurry up, because this is important.
No, I want to get back to I know I'm detracted. But anyways, this is going to enhance what Helen's going to talk more about, is you chop a turtle's head off. I'd grab with a channel lock plier his head, pull the head out, cut off with an axe, hang him up by the tail, and you'd have to wait 6-7 hours sometime before you could clean that turtle because he was clenched up and clawing, right? I was down in Guyana hunting with Amerindians. So it's like, here we'll say like Native American or Indian, South America's Amerindians. We're hunting with Amerindians. They caught a big river turtle. First thing they did was they just whittled a big long stick, ran it through that thing's backbone, and that thing was ready to eat, and the meat was super tender. it wasn't flexed. And they cooked that turtle right in his own shell. And they did the same thing. And I just kind of like, I was like, wow, that's crazy. But then the next time I saw that happen was when you guys were doing that to porgies. Poor porgies. But
they put him in like an ice, like a saltwater ice bath. But they do, I mean.
After you destroy after you their spinal column.
And spike their brain.
What's that mean?
Spike their head. Like you take like a gaff and, you know, basically spike it in its head.
Well, so which one stun- first?
It stuns it.
Then you wire it.
Yeah, them. Yeah.
What's the discipline called?
EKGMA.
And how many steps process is it?
J-I-M-E. I think it's like a 3-step process. So John would be better to
you head
to
first,
really
then tail, then
I think
wire?
You spike the head first, and then you cut the, like, towards the tail, but not the end. It's like you have a little meat left, and you kind of just fold it over, and then you stick a shark wire or something.
And dude, that fish is cashed out after you do that to
wow.
it.
You basically run it all the way to its head.
I will catch a Chinook at some point on my fly rod.
You should do that, yeah.
And yes, I will do this.
And then you put it in an ice bath.
I'm going to find some things to practice on.
They did a chef blind test, blind taste test for this.
Like, is that right? And they could taste it?
So we went out once and we had zip ties and it was like a science experiment. We had like, this one was just like the Montauk way where they just, you know, take a... like a bat and just like hit it in its head
and throw it
and
on ice
throw
water.
It on ice. So we did it that way, then we did it, you know, EKGMA way, then we did it, like, you know, all these different ways. And then we actually, it wasn't even the same day, it was like 24 hours or 48 hours afterwards. And then the chefs, you know, we put on different plates and they actually picked the EKGMA one, which was incredible.
Is that right?
Yeah,
that day we did that. What's funny is like a lot of times you'll see a bunch of sports, you know, on a guide boat, and you'll see where they're flaying the fish. And you hear them all go like, oh, no, you go, like, the people are like, oh, you go ahead and take them. No, no, if you want them, you go ahead and take them. And you're like, dude, I guarantee you that in 1 year, all that fish is going to be freezer burned and getting thrown in the garbage.
Yeah.
But we ate half our fish before we left. We were mowing, man. That was fun. That was a fun day. EKGMA?
EKGMA, yeah. There's a YouTube video of a guy in, like, Japan doing it.
But not
like
your boyfriend?
There's a video somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he wrote about it, right?
Yeah, he wrote a piece about it for the food magazine, Lucky Peach.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it has broken down. It's more, it's he's more, a good it's cook, definitely man. More than 3 steps.
He's a good cook.
You know.
Yeah. New York City fish murderer.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Who'd have thought Helen's
we gotta bring him on
the
there.
Most fish blood on her hands.
Yeah.
Yeah, and spinal fluid. Well, you got spinal fluid on your hands.
Well, what's the deal with fly fishing? It seems like everyone's all about numbers instead of like, because when we fish in Long Island, it's like, oh, I got this like doormat, you know, double digit fluke, you know, like the size and mm-hmm. versus like, I mean, like, obviously, you can alter regulations, so you can only keep a number of things. But I'm not like, I caught 50 porgies today.
No, yeah. It's like one good fish. Like, you'll go on like the Missouri or, you know, the Yellowstone or something that has the potential to be like, there's a big fish in there. People catch them all the time.
Yeah.
Just hasn't been me. You know, and a lot of days, like, you're like, okay, I'm going to throw like a big streamer or do something that I've told myself is the way to catch a big fish, and it's a one fish day or a zero fish day. You know, yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I once wrote something about how I was like imagining the world, like if we could go back to the beginning of human existence and have all the same conditions and let everything run forward again. Just to see what would happen, right? I think a lot of the things that happened would happen all over again, okay? I think that we would probably, a lot of people would develop sort of monogamous relationships, okay? Like, there's all these things of human behavior that I feel like if you just backed it up and let it go again, the same thing would happen. We would hunt, we would fish, right? We'd probably form government, language would have happened again. I'd say there's a couple things. Wearing your pants down around below your ass would not happen again. And I don't think catch release fly fishing would happen again. I think it must have been a total fluke. Because I feel that like when people, and I do it too, so I'll talk about me too. I think it's like some wiring got crossed in your head where you feel that as a human, and I'm saying this about myself, as a human, like I'm supposed to be out extracting. Okay. I'm supposed mm-hmm. to be out hunting and fishing. Because for however long you want to define human history, you want to go back 75,000 years, 50,000 years, there's always, you know, everybody basically says some last 100,000 years, whatever, anatomically modern humans. We've been doing these things, hunting and fishing. And I think people are kind of like, but I'm a little civilized. Like, I'm not cool with the death, but I have to do the act. Like, I have to do it.
Yeah, you're doing it for pleasure at that point.
Yeah, but I just don't see where it came from. It's like golf with fish.
Where did cave art come from, right? Like, part of it was I want to express myself. The other part of it is it's pretty brutal out there. I'm probably going to waste some time in here. Make some paintings.
Yeah.
It's like it's a form of entertainment, right? Yeah.
It somehow could be superfluous to survival.
And you couldn't tell me that these guys were like, okay, I know I can catch a bunch of these things. I'm going to kill all of them, even though I know I can't eat them, right?
Yeah.
I mean, those people at the time would be like, boy, there's a lot of, you know, this fish in this area, this, you know, rabbit population's really good here. I'm going to take a couple and come back later, right? So in a fishing scenario, they're catching fish in this spot. Be like, boy, it's fun catching fish. Practice, I know I can catch them. Right.
I'm not going to bonk you've answered your own question. I think that human beings are just hardwired to do exactly that. Like, you know, they like getting it on. That's like hardwired in. And so fishing.
By that, you mean lovemaking.
Correct.
Yeah.
Making
sweet. I don't know what you meant, because a lot of people say, like, let's get it on, let's go fishing. Yeah.
But it's the same kind of deal, just hardwired in. Like, this is fun. Why it's fun, I have no idea. It's just fun.
I was talking to a friend of mine, who's an evolutionary biologist, and we were talking about that, like, the benefit, like, the evolutionary benefit of sex being enjoyable is that people will continue to procreate outside of intent. You know, my wife's pregnant right now with a kid we weren't exactly planning on. So
you're preaching to the choir.
So she was saying, like, I wonder, and she doesn't hunt. We took her out spearfishing in the Bahamas. We went spearfishing, and after, she's like, why is that fun? You know, she's like, I wonder if it's not fun because it was, like, advantageous for it to seem fun to us. That it would mean, like, even beyond desperation, that we'd be out there hammering it. Like, out there fishing, out there hunting. Like, if you draw some kind of pleasure from it, it's not an onerous task. But you'd have it be that, yeah, I'm just out there. And even though I'm not absolutely out of food, I'm out there doing it anyway. Because it's just it's what I enjoy doing. Like, there's possibly, there is some huge adaptive advantage to us thinking it's fun to catch fish.
It is huge because, for instance, if you didn't enjoy it that much, you wouldn't do it that much. And when it got truly difficult, you might not be that good at it. Whereas the guys that really enjoyed it, almost to the point of, you know, overdoing it, when things got really difficult, they were the only guys that were actually catching fish and the only guys that, you know, were eating enough to go procreate.
Dude, if you wrote that, you would get it published in, like, Science or Nature.
I'm sure.
Yeah, I like it.
That's, yeah, like, the best theory I've ever heard in my entire life.
That's evolution.
I almost want to end this right now.
I'm sure it's on a
poster.
No, post
I actually want to back it up. I want to back it up and end it earlier and then steal that idea. So hold on, cut all that out. I'm going to do it. Okay, we'll be right back. And I'm going to say what Ken just said.
You know, but that's how it works, right? Push comes to shove, if the guy is totally obsessed, he's going to be just a little better.
So let's say,
what if he's obsessed and just just completely horrible at fishing?
I already know that guy. There's no way I can say his name, but I fish with him. The most obsessed fisherman I know is the worst fisherman I know.
That's what I'm saying.
It's like a curse.
All we can hope is that he makes god-awful love to the woman who doesn't like fishing, but if she did, would be extraordinary at it.
Yeah.
And then you create...
This dude is the worst angler, and I feel... A lot of times when people are bad hunting and fishing, I feel that what they lack is killer instinct. Like, what my brother would say, they lack grr.
The grr factor.
Yeah. It's like they lack grr, and they don't have, like, what it takes to go, like I'm going to kill that thing. Right. Even though you're not going to kill it. Like, today when I'm fishing, I'm not... Like, if I see a fish come up to grab my... comes up to pop a dry fly. I don't, in the moment when it's happening, the moment when my mind's registering his presence, I'm lifting the rod, I'm not thinking, oh, you sweet fish, I love you.
Right.
I'm more inclined to say, oh, you son of a, you know what I mean? Yes. It's like I have an antagonist, even though I love the essence of the thing, in that moment, I feel, this is going to come off weird, I feel a very distinct, like a hatred for that fish if he doesn't grab my fly.
Right. Yes.
If I hook him, then I like him again.
Correct.
If he comes off, I don't like him.
But if you go to set the hook and your line goes in a pile, expletives follow.
And I hate the fish.
Normally directed at that fish.
Yeah, I hate the fish. It's like, I'm like, I hope something bad happens to you and you die.
You just project it.
And someone does, what's that word again? To your spine.
EKG.
Someone EKG meets you.
EKG is that
EKG. I'm just going to do like EKG, like E, like echo kilo.
Helen, to her credit, did not mutter, I think, any expletives on the river today.
Did you love them?
No, I was very upset with myself. But
we were watching the little trout eat bugs next to her fly, and I was the one sitting there being like, "Yes, hurt."
But now that being said, so you take an example of somebody that doesn't have the gur, but I think that the gur in general can possibly be learned when it comes to hunting. I mean,
you acquire gur.
Perhaps. When you first go out with a...
Can you bottle it?
I don't know. When you first go out hunting with a bow, though, and you get your first couple close counters with like a big bull, it's kind of, I don't know, you're kind of sometimes like, can I shoot? You know what I mean? And then after a while,
you get rattled,
I think, and it freaks you out. But then after a while, I wouldn't say hopefully you never get comfortable with that situation. It's always exciting, but it goes from kind of like, wow, this is great, to like, how am I going to get an arrow in that animal?
Yeah. That's the thing I've said a lot about, particularly bow hunting, but when you pull back on an animal, you have to know that thing's going to die. Because if you're like, I hope this doesn't happen, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It will happen. But the guy who could be like, I will now kill you.
Yeah.
That's more of a successful attitude than sort of being like, well, let's see what happens.
Yeah.
there goes my arrow.
Agreed. And that's probably why, there's probably some synergy here between rifle versus arch bow and spinning or bait fishing versus
that's what I thought
fly
but
fishing,
I mean I've personally never gone hunting, but I imagine fly fishing is like bow hunting versus like bait fishing or jigging or something.
Oh conventionally. My god, it's like I would have ended the podcast.
Here's the similarity in that with archery you have got to practice a lot.
Yep.
You got to practice, and the practice becomes enjoyable, like leading up to the season you practice every day for a few months at least, and it becomes part of your daily ritual. You enjoy the shooting of the bow, right? Whereas fly fishing, I think a lot of times, even if fly fishing is not that great, you kind of enjoy the actual act of casting. Whereas I'm not sure if it's the same with, chuck and bait.
No, and I'll tell you what, we just got back from our place in Alaska bouncing a pound of lead in 250 feet of water for halibut.
Right.
And you don't enjoy that.
Right.
It's not like, I love lifting this pound of lead up and bouncing on the bottom. But I'll tell you what you do like.
Halibut.
When that thing goes...
Yes.
And he's on there and he's smoking line out and you have no idea if he's 200 pounds or
that sounds awesome,
dude. I'm telling you. But yeah, there's no finesse, there's no art,
and to a large extent I think that fly fishing, you got to practice without even fishing, generally speaking, for at least a week or two.
I want to interject to say though that Giannis had my four-year-old was fishing with us this morning. My four-year-old, he hooked a fish on like the first time he ever laid his hand on a fly rod.
Yeah. Four-year-old.
My hand was also...
It took him a long time to catch fish on his Zebco spinning reel. Even though he smokes. That's actually something I wanted to bring up, because all my little boy knows about, like, at home when we eat, we just eat game, wild fish and wild game at home. So he's always, every night when we eat, we're talking about where this came from. Daddy killed this thing and here's what happened. He's always talking about the moose that ran daddy over, which Ryan Callahan knows that moose well.
We're all still eating on that moose.
I know. So he always knows these stories. And he's never heard anyone, because he's young enough where I know what his influences are. You know what I mean? Like, he's not off with kids that I don't know, and, you know, I know who he hangs out with. I take him fishing, and we're at my mom's, the lake I grew up on, and we're on my mom's pontoon boat, and he catches 5 bluegills. I mean, he's, like, making his own casts, reeling them in, like, legit catches 5 bluegills. We go home, and I scale the fish, and when I'm flaying bluegills, I just cut their head off first. It's just easier, you know? I get a cleaner fillet. So I come in by their, not pecs. Yeah, pectoral fins. No. What's the fin up by the right below the gill plate? I don't know. Can't remember.
No, it's pectoral fin.
Is it? So anyway, I come in there, cut the head off, and then I flam. So as I go in and cut the heads off, and I got the heads in one pile and the bodies in another pile, and he's up on a chair next to me helping. And he was like legitimately, honestly upset. And it came from an organic place, because this isn't something that I know that no one has said to him it's bad to kill fish. All he's ever heard is that it's good to kill fish. That's what we eat. He was upset. And you could tell that he didn't articulate it this way, but he looked at those fish. He told me, I don't like that you put their heads like that and their bodies like that. He didn't say it, but it was like, it was disrespectful. And he said, this exactly, he expressed regret that we killed those fish and we should have put them back in the lake. So
where'd that come from?
It came from somewhere, and I'm telling you what, it's like, it's not, he's not saying something that someone else.
Well, it could have come from Finding Nemo or something.
He's never seen that movie.
He didn't kill Nemo just then?
No, it wasn't that, man.
I'll tell you my experience.
Telling you what, I'm sensitive to that because, well, you know, I always call killer whales. You're supposed to call them, now, like a lot of like softies call them orcas. But orca is just some, like, it's like a Greek word that means whale. They used to call them whale killers because now you can't call them killer whales because people think it gets a bad reputation. I always call them killer whales. One day my kid comes back, he's like, you know, you got it all wrong. I was down at the Seattle Aquarium. It's an orca. So now he always calls them orcas. So he cited to me where he heard contrary information. No one, I'm telling you, no one has told that kid.
Well, nobody told this kid that you can't call a killer whale.
You know, like, that? Yeah. It's an orca.
And are we hurting the whale's feelings? What do you mean give them a bad
apparently
reputation?
I don't know. Yeah. I have no exactly. idea what they're at.
I think they're like badasses, right?
Yeah, so. And orca just means whale. It's the stupidest thing in the world. But like some of my dearest friends are like, oh, it's an orca. One day I was with these guys, speaking of all this. Am I getting way too far afield? Can I tell a quick story? Okay, I was working on a book about buffalo. And everybody knows buffalo's a bison. So the American bison, the American buffalo. It's not actually a buffalo, blah, blah, blah. People been calling them buffalo a hell of a lot longer they've been calling them bison. I've never said to someone in my life buffalo and had them be confused about what I was talking about. Yeah. Okay, on this continent. Anyways, I was with these guys when I was working on my book. I spent some time with these guys' buffalo field campaign. Okay, so they're like they're pretty radical environmentalists who have a certain vision for American buffalo or American bison. And their group's called the Buffalo Field Campaign. So their group uses a name that's not the scientific proper name for the species, which is bison. I'm standing with this guy outside of Yellowstone Park in Gardner, Montana, and I see an antelope. Okay? I go, hey, check out those antelope over there. It's actually pronghorn, he says to me. I'm like, dude, you work for a group that calls something the wrong name. Oh, it drove me nuts, man. I can tell that bothered me more than bothers you guys.
So is it?
So true? Yeah, do you say antelope or pronghorn? Just like
everything under the
prairie goat,
speed goat, prairie goat.
Yeah, pronghorn, antelope.
I combine them now. I found myself doing like the weirdest thing.
Should have been like it's antelope, capra, americana.
Prong-a-lope.
That'd be good. I always say pronghorn, antelope, and I'm like, well, like why? But I just say
let's
that.
Let's put prongalope. There's no confusing that. Antiprong.
All right, what were we talking about before I got off on that?
Jimmy.
He had like a natural. Yeah.
And I got to say, my experience with folks from Michigan who fish, this kid is like gone way off the reservation. Because all the Michiganders I know, like they fill the freezer.
Yeah.
That's the program.
Well, he told me now, I gave him not a stern talking to.
Is it a Michigander?
But he told me this morning, he goes, I get it now. He's like, I get it now. You know, and I don't know what that means, but he's like, now it's okay. But when he let that cut go today, he said, I'm quoting him. He said, there you go, back in the wild.
Okay, I got to visit something. So you guys eat bass out there?
Largemouth? I eat them as a political statement.
What does it taste like? I tried cooking bass one time in a bind, and let me tell you, it didn't go great.
My fishing mentor, who grew up about 6 houses down from me, was a man named John Gary. He fished so much and caught so many fish that he sold like a black market fish sales. He's dead now. And right before he died, I was over his house, and he offered to sell me. He's like, I'll make a deal. I'll sell you my house. Everything in it down to my shoes. Lakefront property. Say, I'll sell you this house for $75,000. You give me the money now. The only deal is I live here till I die. And when I die, you have everything down to my shoes.
Why do you want to keep his shoes after he died?
He's saying that I would be buying everything he's ever owned on the agreement that he could get the money now and continue to live in his house till he died. And I didn't take him up on that deal. I should have ran down to a bank. Anyways, he ate a lot of bass and largemouth bass, and he soaked them in milk and grilled them.
Whoa.
Skin on, took largemouths, soaked them in milk, grilled them skin down.
Scaled them.
No.
Oh.
No, because what he would do then, he'd put the fish on the grill, skin down, scales on. He'd cook it till it got, you know, they get loose from their skin. He'd then take the fish and flip it back over onto its skin so it didn't get stuck to the grill. Finish it like that, and he would eat them all the time like that.
What'd it taste like?
Muddy fish.
Yeah.
What is the milk thing?
Because it helps with the muddiness. I'm telling you, it does, man. Does it? I'll Pepsi challenge it any day of the week. I soak catfish in milk.
Better than like salt water. Like,
I don't know. I can't answer that question.
It's an interesting thing that you brought up because a lot of the people that live by the ocean and fish in the rivers, they don't even keep any fish unless they catch them within like 5 miles.
Because ocean fish are 10 times better than freshwater
fish.
That's
what they say. They say, I don't even like it.
That's not even debatable.
They taste it. They're like, they catch big 40-pound salmon, going back. It's like, I don't even, and if it's like more than 2 miles or whatever, you know, off the, away out of the ocean, forget it.
Well, with salmon, it makes sense because when a salmon goes to enter, he's in the best shape he's ever going to be in for his entire life.
Right.
When he leaves the ocean. When he's at the mouth, right, if he's still actively feeding near river mouth, he's never going to be in better shape. He's got a higher fat content than he's ever going to have the rest of his life. And the minute he enters that river, he's degraded. He's going downhill.
And they taste like mud.
They just get worse and worse. And they get, pretty soon they got like fungus and lesions all over them. But, but now I eat largemouth just as a political statement. Every time I kill a largemouth and flat, I like to put it on social media. because I know I'm not damaging a fishery when I thump a largemouth. It's not.
But how often do you guys eat like trout or like, I mean, because people are eating.
I just ate a trout. I ate a trout the day after, I ate a rainbow the day after me and Giannis here contracted trichinosis.
You guys both got trichinosis from bear. 98% of the cases of trichinosis come from bears.
So anyways, we ate some trout and grayling. One of them was caught on a fly pole.
A fly rod.
I call it a fly pole. As a political statement. As a political statement, I call it a fly pole.
See, I think the ideal thing would be to just because of my like water access, to learn how to fly fish, but salt water. So then you can target like bluefish
tasty
and
fish.
Striped bass and stuff on the fly. Because to me, it's like a progression. Like as a fisher, fisherman or whatever, it's like, okay, you can bait fish, you can jig, you can do all, but it's like, what's the next step, like the next challenge? It's like fly fishing is to me like much more challenging, obviously because I'm a beginner, but like,
you cannot make a statement like that.
You don't think so?
No. Okay, go up and show me how easy it is to go mooch like a big 30-40 pound king.
I guess it's because I've never done it.
It's so simple. Yeah. I don't even know what you do. It's like, it's not. It depends on the situation.
It depends on the species,
you just put your bait over the side.
Okay, go to my mom's. Go stand on my mom's dock with a beadhead pheasant tail when the bluegills are on the beds and tell me how tough it is to hook them on a fly rod. You can't keep them off.
That's true. I guess it depends on the situation.
It just depends on the situation.
Yeah, that's true.
But situations where you cannot keep them off, I change things up. Because I'm like, okay, I know I can catch them this way.
Really?
Yeah, I do all the time. And when we fish steelhead, I'm like, okay, I know for a fact today I can catch a fish this way.
Yeah.
But if they're that hungry to eat everything I throw in this way, I bet I can tie this on and catch catch a few fish.
So when you're like hammering ducks on a great day, I know you like to hunt ducks. Mm-hmm. Do you ever start shooting left-handed?
No. No, I do not.
Do you ever start like pouring out half the shot out of your shot shell and putting it back together again and shooting that?
No, I do not.
Okay. Just curious.
But the thing, I'm eating those too.
Yeah.
You know, typically, but I really don't eat steelhead.
You would if you were hammering them, switch to a 12 gauge instead of a 20 instead of a 12.
You would?
Yeah.
I don't know anybody that's ever done that in the history of my life.
That's common out here.
Perhaps
to
you
go
should get
out duck hunt with a 12 and a 20 and be like, if I start really knocking them dead, I'm going
to
switch to my
20. You're like, the hunting's been good. It was good last night. I'm shooting with the 12. I'm shooting with the 20 tonight. There's some other reasons. The 20 is significantly quieter. So
it's probably because your head hurts from shooting your 12 all day.
Maybe.
Hurts so good.
Right, we watched a movie last night with a guy shooting ducks with a
black powder. Now that is respect. Like, I respect that.
Right, but why is he doing that?
For the challenge.
No, he said
it's fun. I respect that.
It's fun.
Yeah, well, it's just like fun's a synonym
for
challenge.
Wait, a black powder with...
This dude hunts ducks with... So this is... Okay, last night... We're at the hunt and film tour, sponsored by First Light, sponsored by as a fundraiser for backcountry hunters and anglers. I spoke there briefly, a couple minutes. I had 5 minutes to explain to people why public land is important, why backcountry is important.
Which is typically like a 5 minute subject.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I tried to cover it as quickly as possible. Probably took me 6 minutes to explain a little bit about why we need more of it around. Or not more, there's no way to get more. You don't get more of it. Why we need to hang on to what we have. And there was a film there about a dude who made a little wetland and was shooting exposed hammer black powder at ducks. And he's saying, if I could go out like a limit 7, if I can get 2 with this, it's better to me than getting 7 with something else.
Yeah.
I just thought he don't like duck meat that much.
Could be the case.
Now, I'll tell you the fly fisherman I'm going to respect. And again, I keep on it because there's two things. There's a guy out, there's like a bunch of guys out there right now super annoyed because they're probably the meat slayingest people on the planet who like fish fly rods, right? They probably fish stripers on a fly rod, thump every fish they get, eat them all day long. They don't think that there's this dichotomy where it's like, oh, you fish with spin reel, so you must be a meat guy, and you fish with a fly rod, so you must not, because there's a hell of a lot of guys that fish largemouth bass with spinning tackle and never kill a fish ever, right? So it's not like it's not a dichotomy, but just, I'm talking about general trends, particularly in the Western U.S. Anyway, so there's that I should clear up. I want to meet the guy, and Giannis alluded to this today. I want to meet the guy who not just cuts the barb off his hook, but cuts the whole hook off before the bend, because he's so pure of heart, so pure of mind, that he just wants to see that fish come up and lip the thing.
But we can make a phone call where we would not get a hold of Ted himself, but I can get a hold of probably the guide who guides Ted.
I'm guessing you don't mean Ted Nugent.
No. Way cooler than Ted Nugent. But this dude's, he could darn be close to 90 years old, and he's fly fished the Eagle River for 30 years.
Yeah.
And floats all the time. And on those good days when they're just like I was saying, every couple minutes you're getting a hit on the dry. He catches a couple, kind of gets the tug out of the way, and then just starts clipping the hook.
Is that right?
No,
because he just loves the.
He feels like it's getting in his way to fight, net, release, and all that out of the fun he's getting out of casting and watching those fish eat that dry.
Yeah, Helen, how long have we been going for?
An hour and 8 minutes.
All right. What Since I got you, First Light Boys sitting right here, what's cool on the horizon? Are you gonna make a coat that lures in bull elk?
We work on scents all day in the office. It is, you come in there and it just assaults.
It's called the cow in estrus coat.
Yeah, it's odorific in that office.
No, what's going on? So you got.
I do really appreciate you, mentioning that we do try to keep a live person in the office.
When's this going to go on? When's this going to be on the radio?
I don't know. Whenever I feel like it.
Like how long? A week?
I don't know. Why does that matter? Just tell us what's happening. Cool. Yeah, first day, man. Oh, because you got. Oh, because you're worried? Okay, yeah, you're safe. I mean, what you tell me at what point.
Yeah, no, you can tell. Yeah.
Tell me at what point.
2 weeks.
Okay, you're fine. Right?
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we don't. If it's something that you don't want us to release, you won't do it.
Yeah, that's fine. We're just talking about the
you
new.
You guys coming out
pattern.
Of a line of swimwear?
We're coming out with our new camouflage pattern.
Really?
Yep. Yep. It was designed by a guy an ex-army guy who was just super, super into camo, and we started development maybe, I don't know, well over a year ago, and we're coming out with a new camo pattern that we've just for First Light.
I'm excited to see it.
Yeah.
That's a good idea, though.
Yeah, it is. You know, we've really liked a lot of the existing camo patterns, and they certainly work great for certain environments, but we kind of wanted to take some of the technology of a few different patterns and kind of blend them into one and kind of make a camo pattern that worked well in a bunch of different environments.
Does it have a name?
Fusion.
Really?
Yeah, First Light Fusion.
And you're going to make all your stuff in that?
Yep, and it'll all be available here by the end of the year. Most of the base layers and stuff should be available in the next week or so.
But no one's seen it. Haven't seen it.
Nope, no one's seen it. No one's seen it. We didn't have it at the SHOT Show. It's just so difficult to get. We have so many different fabrics now. We had no idea if we could even pull it off this year. So basically, we just went forward with the program and said, if we can do it in time for hunting season, fine. If not, whatever. But, you know, there's just all these different, all the fabrics have to match. You know, you might buy one synthetic top from one end of the country and another merino piece from another end of the country. You want to wear them together. So you got to.
Oh, and it'd look different.
Yeah. So you really got to struggle to get all those colors to match and everything. So it takes a long time. So once we got all our factories all in line, we told them, you know, let's go when we were building it. So we're going to have stuff ready shortly.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Was you the first person to ever put camouflage on merino wool?
Yes. Basically.
Which is not an easy thing to do.
It was a total pain.
It's Kenton.
Yeah, it was me. We started
wearing. You got a box of Crayola crayons?
Yeah, exactly. Melted them, put them in the oven, bam. No, we started, we were all totally into hunting, and then we started wearing, you know, we live in a ski town. So then kind of in the early 2000s, you know, merino stuff kind of came into the ski and snowboarding and snowmobiling scene pretty heavy, you know, and we started switching over to that.
Like people started wearing it just because they realized it didn't reek. Like it wasn't so
exactly.
smelly and
they
uncomfortable.
Started, they started, yeah, it didn't smell, and it's just way more comfortable even when you do sweat. And then, you know, we were all super into archery hunting and hunting in general, and it didn't take long to figure out that this would be way better than the existing products for hunting. But at the time, nobody printed on merino. You know, people are like T-shirt style, maybe like, you know, a finished T-shirt, and they'd print, you know, something like cutesy on it, but not like large rolls, just rolls.
Yeah.
So it took us about 18 months to find a factory that could actually do it. You know, we tried a couple different things and it didn't feel good or whatever. Then we found a guy that could do it and do it well. And that was the beginning of the company. The first year I showed up at the SHOT Show with literally like a duffel bag and I had five pieces, you know, and that was it. And just kind of hung them up and, you know.
Some weird dude.
That was weird.
Ken,
you know,
was wearing whites with your like skater Levi's.
Like white boots?
Tucked in shirt.
Why, those are my hunting boots, you know? I wore whites up until like 8 years ago. They're just the most comfortable shoes I'd use.
You mean white logger boots or the
yeah,
pants?
Logging. Yeah, that's what I used for about. Logging. And that's what we used for, you know, walking around. It wasn't until probably 7 or 8 years ago that we kind of got into the more you know, technical stuff, but that's what we'd work in all day. So we figured out it's great for hunting. But the fact is, it's kind of a different deal, you know. And once we switched over to, you know, now I use handbags, but, you know, Solomons or whatever, just having something lighter. The thing with whites is that if you have to wear them every single day, you'd wear out a pair of Solomons in 6 months.
And when you
months.
See a guy on a trade
I'm
show
with,
floor.
Yeah, like, yeah, they're not meant, I mean? Yeah, they're not intending that you're actually just going to wear them around
right.
on hard surfaces all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Or even in, you know, in the woods, you destroy them. Whereas a pair of whites you wear for whatever, you know, 2 years, you send them out to get them resold and they're good to go.
I keep a pair of Schnees for hunting.
Yeah.
And I keep a pair of Schnees for not hunting because I don't want my hunting boots to get screwed up walking on sidewalks and stuff like that.
Right, yeah, you know makes I mean? Sense. Totally.
It dulls the edges down too
big
bad,
time.
And then you can't cut in on hills, you know.
Big time.
Yeah, and going down hills, they still aren't as good as whites. But the fact is that you know our hunting season out here it's only whatever 10 weeks. So you'd rather have a pair of shoes that they don't have to last that long. You just have to work really well and be really light and make it so you can carry a, you know, 80, 100 pound pack down a hill, and all of a sudden. once you realize that, it's nice, you know.
I think for the listener, we should explain what whites are.
Yeah, because I don't know what whites
are. Yeah, I just barely know.
They're out of Spokane.
Yeah, they're out of Spokane, American made. They're just like, they're, you know, what you see all the Forest Service guys wearing, the logging guys.
It looks like, to the untrained eye, it looked like a lady boot.
Yeah, the heels just are got a big heel 2 inches.
It, you know? Yeah, pretty low pro.
Yeah, they're 2 inches, and then they've got just regular Vibram soles, but they can rebuild them for you, you know.
You send in like, I used to have some whites pack boots, which just like real heavy. I used to use them climbing trees in the wintertime because I used to do arborist work.
You know?
We get these winter contracts doing boulevard maples. I remember one year we did 300 and some boulevard maples, and Sundays it's 10 degrees below zero because this is cutting trees in Montana, and I would put tree spikes on over them because they're so rigid.
Right.
But I always thought they're like kind of too rigid for hunting.
You know, they were, but they break in. But that's, you know, that's before we'd spend all day in the woods. You know, we had a logging business, firewood and whatever. That was just what you wore. And then after a while, though, you know, you realize, wow, there's some way better options there.
Yeah.
Especially because they don't have to last, like I said, you know, maybe a season or two seasons max, and you're ready to buy a new pair, you know?
You know, I want to talk a minute about, you know, just talking about wool, because you guys do such a nice job with the merino wool stuff. Wool's had a weird history, because my old man started hunting after World War II. So he started hunting. He got back from World War II in 1945. Got into hunting. He said at the time, like, you didn't have, like, sporting goods like you have now, you know? He said they just hunted in their clothes. They hunted in their military surplus stuff. He said for 10 years, it's still the best stuff you could have. And he just spent 2.5 years crawling around, essentially camping out, you know, from all through Italy up into Europe in wool clothes and living in a foxhole camp. So he said they just hunted in that stuff. And he tells a funny story where he used to just hunt with other vets, you know, and they were out one time in a field hunting. Everybody had their army surplus stuff on. I guess it wasn't surplus back then, their army stuff back on. And someone took a shot. He said a couple of those guys out in the field all hit the deck. Like, it was like still like in their head, you right. know what I mean? But he always hunted in wool. I mean, all the time I was growing up, my old man wore, you know, those like green wool.
Yeah, like the.
They're not surplus, but I don't remember who makes them. But it's like a field pant.
Yep.
And you die hiking into your tree stand. You'd be like so sweaty, you know.
Right.
We used to like hike in and then put your pants on when you got there because right. they're so warm. This thick green wool. And my mom would buy bulk wool fabric and sew clothes for me and my brothers out of wool that we would hunt in. I wish I had saved them. We all had pants and a jacket that my mom made out of wool. We sit up there, hotter than hell. And I remember, like, when I was a little kid, they came out with that King of the Mountain wool clothes.
Yeah.
And getting that catalog and just dreaming over that trapper pullover. It was like a $400 washable wool jacket. It seemed like it was like unfathomable that you'd like have that kind of money to buy some sort of garment. And then Cabela's came out with a washable wool. It was supposed to be like a knockoff of King of the Mountain. And they were half as much. And I bought a pair of those pants and washed them, and they were like spandex. And my buddies right. would be like, they'd be like, dude, what are those? I'm like, listen, man, you're looking at a lot of money right now. I don't care what these things look like. I'm wearing them. And then now, with like your guys' stuff, like you honestly can put it in. It's like you wash in the washing machine.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
It is. I mean, but it's
like still the best fabric, and it grows on the back of sheep.
It's good line for a bachelor.
I didn't even know that. I wasn't even aware of like wool. But, you know, I mean, I've been wearing Poly Pro since I was 10 years old.
Dude, when I started hunting the mountains, we looked like dudes out of the REI catalog.
Yeah.
We wore mountain clothes.
Yeah.
We didn't have anything actually meant for a hunter. One, because it was all too big.
Right.
If you're like a skinny guy who runs around the mountains a lot, it's too big for you.
Right.
Then, and so we just wore like mountaineering clothes. We hunted in mountaineering clothes.
Same exact yeah. thing.
We'd have like blue and red, you know what I mean? It was yeah. like hard. We'd like, I'd like get writ dye and try to like dye stuff right. so it was a little duller.
Yeah.
Some Patagonia stuff, a lot of Sims fleeces.
Totally, man. Totally. And I would get it at, I would go to Goodwill's. I didn't yeah. have a lot of money. I was in school. I'd go to Goodwill's in rich towns. Like if you could hit a Goodwill in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, you know, or hit a Goodwill here.
Catch him, Idaho.
You would go in there and walk out like tricked out and amazing mountain apparel, ski apparel and stuff, and we'd hunt it because it was like so great. Now there's yeah. you know, now people make stuff for like skinny dudes that like they run around the mountains.
Flip side is senior citizen centers. Don't overlook those, because
they flag them.
You get you know, old guy dress sweaters that are 100% lamb's wool.
Oh.
And you can haggle those ladies down at the counter. Yeah.
No, my brother, man, he still does hunt old man sweaters. Yeah. He's like, whoa, what are you talking about?
That's yeah. awesome. It worked. So, yeah, that was it. And then that's, you know, the once everything kind of switched over from synthetics to wool, so did we. And then, you know.
You mean everything meaning the smart people.
I just, you know, like
the people who don't like smelly clothes.
Yeah, the people spend a lot of time outside, you know, like we're in a fortunate to live in a place where everybody spends a lot of time outside, you know. So
this is a fit town, man.
Yeah, a lot
I'm
of
telling you what, last night
people
some fit mugs.
So,
but that's like a fit crowd, you know.
Yeah,
that would come out for something like that. I was kind of blown away, man.
Yeah, I mean, this place is unique too, in that I mean, it's as steep as it gets. Like most places in the mountains, you know, you could still kind of enjoy yourself walking up and down stuff. Out here, everything's like 30 degrees minimum, wouldn't you say? I mean, it's just so steep that
yeah. No, it's
if
amazingly
you're not
steep
pretty
around
fit,
here.
It's really, it just wouldn't be fun. You'd just be like, this sucks.
Yeah, Ryan was showing us a place he likes to hunt. He said, this is one place I can just tell people where I hunt because they're not going to walk up that hill.
It's the dream. I'm like, there's elk up there right now.
Yeah,
and you might be walking yeah. along. You might be walking along and kick something and realize that it's Hemingway's cut-up shotgun.
Right.
Whoa, he brought it full circle. He brought the podcast full circle.
I'll bet you that guy's right there. There's the welder right there. Right.
He's walking by. He's down in the pool.
Yeah, he is. He sold those pieces. Sells one piece off every now and then.
Hon, Helen, show me a note. Just tell me what it is, Helen.
No, we're going to post the show notes on themeateater.com. We'll post links to the AKGMA videos and all of those.
I don't understand what that means. Like, show notes.
Yeah.
We just did a show. Helen's been taking notes.
You know,
you're
like,
going to post
like,
the
no,
show
like,
notes.
Yeah, like links to videos and stuff that people might want to check out.
The EKG.
Video.
Oh!
And relevant stuff about our podcast.
So Helen
are talking
says,
about.
My we'll post spots. Podcast show
Jeez.
Notes.
God,
links,
the worst.
Et cetera. Okay. Correct me if I'm wrong.
We should talk about not forgetting things in the woods, too.
Okay, correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah, Helen. Helen used right. to be Helen right. used to
Here
be the most.
Here we go.
I used to admire Helen's work ethic, and I'm old enough to have sired Helen.
That is not true.
If I was You're not. At 12, I could have sired you at 12 years old.
Yeah.
Actually, I couldn't have. I couldn't have. I'm almost embarrassed to say it. So, Helen lost her phone today when she went to pee in the woods. It's so different for girls to have to go in the woods.
Yes.
I don't lose anything when I pee in the woods because I stay upright. My pockets stay oriented
Good
upright.
Good for you.
But girls got to invert, essentially invert and spill their pockets out.
Did you find it?
No. It's an hour away. She's got to go back and get the thing.
Why do you need to call it?
She's sitting here right now.
How is she going to walk
some dude
back over?
It uphill.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, your mission.
That one guy that was there.
Huh.
So, what was I talking about? Oh.
Show notes.
Should you be listening to this podcast and you're like, man, I wish I knew what they were talking about, you go to themeateater.com and you will find show notes. You'll find like links to stuff that we're talking about. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Why don't you say that? Helen missed her flight yesterday.
I hate you so much.
Mr. Blight lost her phone. Didn't catch it, squat.
It's been a rough week.
Yeah. All right. Giannis Poutelis, anything you want to close on? He's shaking his head no if you can't.
If you can't hear the shake.
I was deep in thought there, but no.
Brian Callahan, closing thoughts? After I brought it full circle with that Hemingway deal, I mean, what are you going to do?
There's nothing. You wrapped it up tight. We got some cooking to do tonight. I'm starting to think about that.
Oh, you know what? Yeah, I want to talk about that real quick. Real fast.
Amazing menu.
So, Backcountry Hunter and Angler fundraiser tonight. I'm doing beaver confit, which is where...
Si, senor.
Yeah, I feel like I had some guy be like, "Oh no, because you don't know what's been done." I just have a feeling that I'm the first guy on the face of the I'm the first guy to ever have made beaver confit. He's like, "You don't know, everything's been done." I'm like, "No, I don't know." That's why I said I think I'm the first guy to ever make beaver confit.
Every tall peak around here has got a Coors Yellow Belly sitting on top of it. You're never the first guy to make it up there.
No. You know what? We were hunting in BC. Remember, we were up on that crazy ridge and the wind was just howling and you looked down, sure enough. 32 caliber Dominion.
Did you look at a cartridge up?
Yes, yeah, Canadian maker.
Wow.
I took a piece of, I took a little bit of white out. I have a, after, on your, per your suggestion, I made a medicine, I didn't do a medicine bag, I did a medicine box.
Cool.
Which is like very a cool. centralized location to put all your weird stuff. So I took that
cool 30, find.
I took that 32 Dominion casing and took white out and made, just, I did like artifacts in the museum. I did white out and then I wrote the date, location I found it. And then I took my wife's nail, what do you call it, nail lacquer? Nail, not polish, it wasn't colored.
Darned if I know.
You know what I'm talking about? Clear nail polish.
Yeah.
And I went over, so I did white out, then I wrote the date and location, then I went over that with clear nail polish, let it dry, and threw it in my medicine box.
Sweet. That's cool that you started. Did you start one?
I've had one for a while.
Dude, I've got boar's tusks. Indian arrowheads.
Well, I have
my
tooth
that fell out of my head
From that black bear.
Do you?
Sitting on my desk at home.
I got pecker bones in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
AKA
swizzle sticks.
Swizzle sticks. AKA baculums. Baculums.
Baculum.
My raccoon baculum off a 20-pound raccoon is as big as a black bear baculum off a 200-pound black
badger,
bear.
Badger, buddy. You start skinning out a badger and you're like,
you just can't get through it because all the baculum. I had to give up. All right, Joe, you already closed your thoughts. You lost your phone. And Joe likes her phone. Kenton?
No, nothing to close with.
All right. Thanks for listening. Tune in for more. Take care. Have a good day.